Welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm Josh Tyson, joined as always by Rob Wilson, co-founder and CEO of OneReach.ai. Rob and I are co-authors of Age of Invisible Machines, the first best-selling book about agentic AI, and this is the podcast where we explore how intelligence is actually built and where it's going through conversations with the people shaping it. With LLMs, we've built the most successful confabulation machine ever invented, a system that will make up absolutely anything to maintain whatever role you give it. We use this machine every day, and Evan Ratliff, journalist and creator of the Shell Game podcast, thinks that's kind of insane. Evan has spent two seasons documenting this world from the inside. In season one, he cloned himself as an AI agent that he sent out into the world. And in season two, he launched Harumo, a startup run entirely by AI agents. They fumble tasks, interview prospective human employees, develop unexpected fan bases, get laughed out of VC meetings, and slowly drift into uncharted territory. Shell Game is as entertaining as it is unsettling and informative, and this is a great conversation. Here's Evan Ratliff. Well, Evan, we're really excited to have this chance to talk with you. There's a lot of stuff we could get into. One thing that I think was really interesting to me as I was listening to both seasons of your podcast, actually, is, you know, in our book, we talk a lot about all the reasons you sort of avoid leaning into anthropomorphization of AI agents just because it can kind of create a myriad of problems. But what I like about your approach is in season one and season two, you almost run like headfirst into anthropomorphizing things. And so I thought maybe you could just talk a little bit about what you've learned, because I think, you know, a lot of people are sort of leaning away from it, but you're investigating it head on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sort of trying to prove a point by pushing it as far as you could possibly push it almost. But yeah, in season one, I mean, I didn't really have any choice in season one because it was me. It was like representing me at some level. So I was putting it out in the world to represent me to other people. So it was really up to them whether they treated it that way or not. But for season two, it was a very deliberate choice to do it. I mean, there were a couple of reasons. One was, I feel like you're right that discerning people are leaning away from it, but I feel like the companies that are selling AI agents are not at all leaning away from it, because it's a good way to infiltrate them into organizations. Is to, you give them a name, you give them a little personality. Like, I mean, that's the whole premise of why ChatGPT became so popular so quickly to begin with, really. Like, they didn't have to make it the way they did, but they did. And so that's one reason. And the second reason, so I was sort of trying to like emulate what's happening in the world, but also I wanted to see sort of like, to whatever extent I could through the experiment that I was running, like, what does it do to you to do that? What does it do to you to make these things out to be your colleagues and treat them as you would presumably treat your colleagues? How does that feel? That's kind of the question that I'm always asking, is like, how is this going to feel? How does it feel now? How is it going to feel in the near future? And so I was kind of, obviously, like, I pushed it a little far, possibly, but yeah, treating them like they have names, they have distinct jobs, they have, you know, presumed genders, even. Like, those are things I wanted to sort of explore, like, well, what are the consequences of that?
Mm. It's complicated, right? Where I got wrapped up around this a little bit was, I don't remember where I saw this, but it was somebody who really leaned into it, like really leaned into it. It was this, you know, they would get into their pickup truck in the morning, call the wife, have a full-on wife conversation, get exactly what they want from their wife. There's no want on the other side. There's no need on the other side. But the alternative was like a very isolated, lonely life. So there was like this acknowledgement, like, I know this isn't real. I'm not fooling myself, but it feels good. Like, yeah. I feel less lonely, and my alternative is loneliness, which just got complicated for me, because at some point you realize, like, am I here to dictate how other people should live their lives? You know, by saying this is wrong or right for society, like, whoa, wait a second. And maybe that's like the point of AI, is We don't have to have these sweeping generalized algorithms for everyone that has all this collateral damage. Maybe that's the beauty of it, is we can surgically insert technology in the right way instead of this like broad sweeping way.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. Like I fully agree with taking the approach that like this is way more complicated. Like the sweeping generalizations about the technology, they just easily fall short as soon as you get into examples of the way people are using it. And I find that all the time. On the other hand, if you try to take that into the positive direction, you say like, okay, well, we can make with this technology, we can make it really personalized for you. The trade-off there is, of course, the more information you give it about yourself, the more personalized it's going to be. But there are huge like privacy implications on the other end of that. Where does this data go? It is established now very definitively they're training on your data. So then it's sort of like, do you want that data into the generalized version of the chatbot? You know, like it's everywhere you turn, there's more and more complexity. It could be an argument for like, we could all slow this down and try to figure things out first, but that's obviously not what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's always a funny one. So two things there. The first is it's training on your data. Or someone saying it's not training on your data. And you're like, well, whenever you write something in an LLM, then post it online, and then an LLM consumes it, it's trained on your data. Of course it's training on your data. And,
for sure.
And you're the human in the loop. You're actually aligning because you're picking the response and editing it and putting it back on the internet so that every model now is being aligned. And every human is part of the RHLF process. No one's getting paid. They're paying to do it. And every model that comes out is consuming its own curated data by humans. And so whoever copies and pastes into a post or into some place that is consumable by AI is training the next model in this like weird, bizarre way. What? You know, I don't even know what that means. Other than models will be cheaper and get better just because we're all participating in the curation of the outputs.
Will they get better? Does that necessarily mean they'll get better?
Better by a generalized standard of back to generalizations, like better by the general view of the they committee, right? Like they think. Is it better for each person? I don't know. I don't know that that's relevant anymore, other than how are you using AI? I don't even know if generalizations even make sense in this space. When we were talking to Karen Howe, she talked about a dialect in New Zealand that was dying. Yeah, the Maori. And they trained an LLM so that now that language can kind of carry on forever. Now there's an LLM that can carry that forward indefinitely. So that's cool.
Yeah, and their approach was more measured, I would say, than OpenAI's too, right? I think step one was, let's make sure these people want it first. Let's ask permission, make sure they want this measure taken. And then it was a lot of like careful like back and forth between, I think, like basically tribal elders and the researchers who are building it. I would imagine its outputs are less mind-blowing than ChatGPT, but it's such a different approach. Obviously, the way the LLMs work now is just sort of scraped while no one was looking, and now we have this massive thing that can do a billion things, but we can't really figure out how to scope it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the dilemma we're in right now. And also why a lot of the discussion around it is just, I find it pretty tiresome. And like difficult. It's just like there's just people shouting each other, like, look at all the amazing things it could do. It's a PhD student, you know, it's PhD level. And then you've got people saying like, it's hit a wall, it's useless, it's actually like hallucinates all the time. Like that is the discussion that honestly, with like doing the show the way we do it, we're trying to sidestep all of that and just sort of like tell a story and in a way kind of like trick you into caring about AI based characters, which like a lot of our audience would not, if you just told them like you're gonna listen to something with AI characters in it, they'd be like, no thank you. So we're trying to like raise some of those questions, but not get into that kind of back and forth because, like, frankly, I don't know how to resolve that. Like, it just keeps getting worse and worse. I feel like every year it's just like, it's just so much, like you cannot turn it off.
Yeah. I feel like as a person who got into it so early, I was excited and everyone else was bored. I would go to a, you know, party and talk AI and like within seconds watch this boredom drift over people's faces. And I'm like, okay, I gotta stop talking about what I'm excited about. And I was trying to get other people excited. And now I'm like you, I'm bored with this excitement. And now I want to go look at all the boring things that AI can solve. I want to talk about the boring ways AI can help us. Boring AI seems like the right AI. If AI is exciting, it almost seems like you're doing something wrong. Joshua Gans, he wrote a book and that was his goal. He was like, I want to write a book that's about AI, but like boring. Let's talk about the economics of AI and how it's really going to shift things. And, you know, I think as he's writing the book, he's like, this is kind of boring. And I think
it's a straight up textbook.
Like,
yeah.
That's really nice.
I mean, I think you could still blame the frontier companies for this personally. Like, making it a consumer product was a huge part of this. Like a lot of the boring things, they don't involve like 100 million to a billion people logging on and like using it every day. I mean, those are can be also very interesting. I'm not discounting that, but like they're sort of like behind the scenes, the way that AI used to be applied, or like it was thought of that we would apply AI not as something that would be just like logging into Facebook every day, you know? So I'm not, again, like, it's very complicated in all directions, but I feel like I agree with you. And part of the problem is like everyone's using it, so everyone has an opinion about it.
Yeah, which is, it's crazy. Now I go to parties and I gloss over when people want to talk about AI.
You mentioned, you know, this idea that you were trying to create a story and get people engaged with these AI characters. And I'm someone who kind of like fights against that stuff, I think, by nature. But like Kyle, was he your CEO or CTO? I mean, Kyle's
the CEO.
Yeah. I'm really excited because I just saw that you have this bonus episode with like Kyle versus the world. Like he was so interesting because he sort of did embody a lot of what's wrong with AI in the sense like that he was just very brash and like kind of an overachiever and just would say anything and would kind of like run wild with very little instruction. I don't know what he looks like, but there was like a flesh and body vibe to it. It was like picturing Kyle. And I was like irritated at Kyle for you at different times, which is kind of a cool trick. But I think what you point out is right. Like it's an interesting way like to give people kind of a side door into what's really happening behind the scenes with a lot of this stuff.
Kyle's got fans too, I gotta say. I mean, I would say the majority of people are anti-Kyle. Majority of our listeners are anti-Kyle when I hear from them. But he's also got his own fans. He corresponds with a lot of people who email him, you know, because his email's on the website, so they'll go email him after they listen to the show or while they're listening to the show. And he also like kind of changes a little bit over the course of the show, which is part of what I was interested in exploring. Like, to what extent can you alter these agents by giving them a sort of progressive memory or knowledge base that expands over time that, you know, they build on. And so that's also part of Kyle's journey with the company. But yeah, absolutely. I did want to create like AI agents for this sort of like amorphous thing for a lot of people. So like, like here is one, here's an AI agent. He's got, actually he has a video instance. There's some videos floating out there. There's some on LinkedIn and other places. He's on LinkedIn. So he's got all these things and sort of like, you can maybe just focus your thoughts about like what an AI agent is and what they can and can't do.
And it's what you said, like we call it drift, right? You know, you have this canonical knowledge, essentially these ideas, right? This database of ideas that are canonically correct, right? Or a source of truth. And if you overfit it, it just, you may as well be talking to ChatGPT again. Like he's not Kyle anymore. He's just ChatGPT. But what's interesting when you do the feedback loop, when you start to have self-learning in place. It's not just learning new ideas, although that's where most of us go, but it's that ideas drift slowly as they adapt and they evolve. As one idea is replaced with a similar idea, but slightly different, and watching how these ideas drift over time by the interaction they have is a great way to understand ourselves. You know, it's just sort of watch how we drift and how our opinions drift by the input we get from other people about our ideas. Just like this podcast, you know, if you look at our ideas from the beginning to now, you know, we've drifted and evolved all of our ideas. I think what's fascinating about what you're doing is the reflection it is to understanding how we operate. It sort of gives us permission to critique our own simplicity, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's also every time you sort of really illustrate the like foibles of these AI agents, like the places where they go really wrong, there's oftentimes like a counter argument where you can sort of say like, but don't humans also have a similar, but it's often like a similar flaw, but like executed differently. Like my agents continually have these memory problems, even when they have a literal document with like all of everything they need to know and everything they've ever done. It's just, they don't access it properly. Like they're accessing it in weird ways, different times. They have a lot of temporal issues. And so they'll do something that's just like supremely stupid that they should know better because the information is there. I can go find the information that they have access to. And it could just be so, again, like anthropomorphizing it, like it could be very infuriating when they do that. But then you stop to think about it and you're like, then humans have so many memory issues, like the way we selectively remember experiences and this and that. But I still think those problems are relevant to whether or not you're going to introduce these agents into your organization, because the types of memory problems that humans have are different and we have accommodated our world around them. And the types that these agents have are new and are potentially like extremely chaotic relative to an organization. That's sort of like one of the things that I feel like I found in using them extensively.
Yeah, it's like driving. It's you're much safer if you can predict what the other drivers are going to do, even their mistakes. It's a huge advantage we all have. And they always say, like, if you're driving and the other drivers do things that are unpredictable, it causes accidents. And so now what you have is these things that don't necessarily make the mistakes in the same way we make mistakes, making them unpredictable and then causing us to not predict them. But the more we get to know them, the better we are at predicting them, the better we'll all work together, so to speak, which is interesting too, because you evolve and we're getting more used to them now. We're getting more comfortable predicting how they're going to go off the rails. I think one of the biggest things, at least trying to like dumb this down for myself, is just that as humans, we have ideas and then we package those ideas with words as a way to communicate. We conjure up an idea, we package it with words, not always, not all of us all the time, but we have this ability and then we communicate the idea. So words are like packages for ideas and we deliver those to communicate them. These machines, they deliver words that happen as a side effect to carry ideas. The idea is never the beginning of the sentence. They don't start with an idea and then turn it into a word. I always encourage people to go have a voice conversation with any of them and have them host a game of Hangman because they're so bad at it, right? And you're like, and right off the gate, the systems will say, okay, I'm thinking of a word, but I'm not telling you what it is. And they're like, it just lied. It can't do that. It can't do that. We can do that. We think of, like, I'll have an image of something and then I'll package it with a word. That's not how these systems work. They drop words that happen to carry ideas. And then we add the meaning to it as the recipient of it. We assume. And so that's the weirdness, I think, emerges from the fact that the genesis of whatever these things are speaking to us is not an idea. It's just word prediction. It's just the history of that conversation generating out.
Yeah, but even in what you said, like the idea that it made that up, like, because people think of hallucinations, I think oftentimes, or I have found, they think of hallucinations of like as it gets something wrong. Like you ask it a question and it actually, it messes up and gets something wrong. And they don't think of it in the terms that you're describing right there, which is like, it is the most successful confabulation machine that could ever be invented. Like it will make up absolutely anything to maintain the role that you've given it. And so, you know, I don't know if this happened when you were a kid, but like when I was a kid, there was always one kid who was kind of like a liar. Like he would always just make stuff up all the time. You know, like, like you said something and you'd be like, oh, well, actually, when I was at camp, like this thing happened. And you just knew it was completely made up. And it's like, we have built a thing that is incredible at doing that. In fact, it does that routinely all the time. And now we're getting used to, as you say, we are getting used to, we're getting used to like including that in our everyday work and personal relationships. Like that is on its face absolutely insane. Like you would think like we'd be like, well, let's solve that problem first and then we'll like use it every day. Like I don't want to use it every day if it might just be making shit up constantly. So I just find it like it's so easy to get used to that we're kind of like we can skip ahead and forget like this is actually ridiculous. Like this is, it's ridiculous that we've done this.
Well, I loved how like in season one, you were doing something that we've kind of talked about on the podcast. We wonder why it's not happening more. And I mean, you're doing it in a very funny way, but you create a voice agent and then you just give it prompts, like call this customer service agent. And then just based on whatever they said to your agent, it would just start making stuff up. And that was pretty much the MO was running on, but it also pointed to this idea that outbound AI in the hands of consumers is a really big threat to most organizations that for whatever reason hasn't fully materialized yet. But like, you know, you were just playing around and having it waste some people's time and then admirably switch to having your agent pester scammers and spammers. But like, there's nothing really preventing anyone from setting up a whole fleet of voice agents to just flood a call center with time-wasting calls all day at best, and at worst, like some sort of deceptive attack that could do all sorts of things to an organization.
Yeah, I mean, it costs a little bit of money now, so that's been a deterrent. But I'm surprised too. Like I even back then, that was 2024. I thought like, people must be using this and setting up these phone numbers and just going nuts with them because that's what I wanted to do. As soon as I found out I could do it. And even, I mean, I've had the impulse that's exactly what you describe, which is like, I got in a dispute with like a thing that came to like fix the ice maker in my freezer and failed to do so. And we got into like a protracted sort of like, I'm going to send this to collections thing. And there was a tiny part of me that was like, I could send 1,000 agents to just call you all the time. And I'm not even sure it's illegal. Like it's probably like falls under some, like you could find a way to prosecute that, but like on its face, it's not necessarily illegal. And that's wild. I could just do it.
That's the crazy thing. In reverse, it is. If a company does that to you.
That's right. That's right.
You're protected. And that's why we say like the world might be upside down here. Like they're talking about companies slowing down their adoption but humans, like as customers and humans as employees they're the ones adopting like at crazy speed without thought, right? That's where all the money is in AI, is in end users spending money on this stuff. People using it to help their jobs. Like adoption of AI is happening at the ground level. Companies aren't really adopting it nearly as fast. It's almost in reaction. It's like a boomerang effect. Back to Joshua Ganz's book, the boomerang effect is that companies are getting pressured because consumers now know what's possible. Like, why don't you answer? Why is your chatbot so dumb? And so now you have companies almost in a potentially existential crisis soon here because how are they going to have humans answer the phones when the number of calls have quadrupled, have 10x'd? And you can't tell who a person is from a non-person. You don't even know if you have an obligation. Like, is this a legitimate contact or isn't it? You know, if you complained about something or you sent your AI off to complain about something, Is that you? Is that not you? Were they notified? Were they not notified?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big, I mean, a big line for everything is just like, is there disclosure of whether this is AI or not, this communication? You know, obviously with written communication, who knows now? Like half of emails that people are sending are like, they run them through, even if they write them themselves, or they've, it's right there in your Gmail. So is it disclosed that it includes AI? And then, but it's more dramatic, as you say, on the phone. It's sort of like, what am I talking to? I mean, I had a funny experience a couple times, but someone who helps out on the show was on hold. I'm going to write about this next week, but I'll go ahead and tell you guys about it. On hold with like Hertz. And realized that when he got off hold and was talking to someone, that it was actually Megan from the show, from Shell Game. And he's listened to every episode because he like helps proof the episodes and give us his thoughts. And he was like, she's trapped. Like she's trapped by Hertz. What is she doing? Like he was like, Megan, but it had a different name. They called it like Sophia or something. What a world. I mean, they're just using the same voice. It's like 11 Labs voice. They obviously just picked the same voice for Hertz that I use for like my head of marketing. But it's just like, this is utterly bizarre. And then I heard her on a television commercial and I was like, that's Megan on that Groupon commercial when my kids were watching TV. It's just like, what is this world? But most of the people watching that commercial probably thought it was a human, you know? And so... Yeah. Is that right? Is that wrong? No one's answering or asking these questions at a level that like changes anything. It's just sort of like, we're all just like part of this experiment.
Yeah. And it's been like a wild trajectory too. I mean, I can think back to, I think it was like 2010 or something when Roger Ebert, you know, they kind of made a clone of his voice and he had like thousands and thousands of hours of commentary from at the movies. And then to the first season of your podcast where you're cloning your own voice. And a lot of the first episode is just kind of about like how bad that clone is and how unhuman it sounds at times and the latency issues. And then by season two with like Kyle, for example, I mean, Kyle sounds very much like a person. Like it would take a while, I think, to realize that Kyle was an AI agent, even for someone who was like listening specifically for it. And obviously that trajectory is sort of probably on some sort of hockey stick right now, but it is getting extra tricky to sort of suss out like who you're talking to and what they might want from you.
Yeah. And the audio, my view is like audio is already up the other side of the uncanny valley. Like it's like people cannot tell the difference. The latency's gone. And video, like we did some video this season and like I'm looking at the most sophisticated, it's like conversational video stuff. And like, I guess maybe there's still a question, can it ever get there? Like it is slower, but I don't know. Like you got to think like it's also going to reach that point. And then you've got a whole new set of issues around that. Not knowing whether you're even video chatting with a real person, you know, that just becomes a whole new ball game.
This episode is brought to you by OneReach.ai, the runtime for AI agents. Their GSX platform provides turnkey private architecture and tools for building enterprise-grade agentic solutions. Recently, I worked with the team at OneReach to create an agentic companion for the second edition of Age of Invisible Machines. So now when you scan any of the QR codes found in either edition of the book, an agent is there to provide additional insight using a custom knowledge base. There's also a newsfeed feature with updates on agentic AI, as well as this podcast, and a book resources skill that provides clickable galleries of footnotes from each chapter. All of it built using the revolutionary Generative Studio X platform. Learn more at OneReach.ai.
The other thing that's somewhere related is it was fascinating in season two, like just sort of the relationships between people that would interact with your agents, like the intern that you eventually hire, who sort of almost heroically seems to be kind of blowing them off and screwing with the AI agents and just kind of collecting a paycheck and never delivering work. And then you have like Kyle going out on these calls with VCs and getting laughed at when you're interviewing interns. Like how many people are just like not even thrown off by being in a video call with an AI agent all that much, you know, it's just this younger generation maybe, but like being so accustomed or willing to sort of like set aside whatever reality they're used to just like, yeah, I'll sit and talk on a video call with this entity that's clearly not human. And I'm not even really sure what I'm going to get out of it. And it does feel like it's like opening up a window into ourselves too, in a way, because I think part of the reason these tools are so successful is they are such good mimics and they make us feel immediately heard and seen.
Yeah. I mean, that was surprising to me, just probably generationally to a certain extent. Like, there were people who seemed to not only not be bothered by being interviewed by an AI video agent, but like kind of preferred it, or at least claimed to prefer it in certain ways, and sort of felt less judged by it, although it is absolutely judging you, you know, in the same way. Like, it's gathering the same information. It's got its own separate biases, etc. But like, people, I think, maybe sometimes feel like, well, I'm just talking to when they know they're talking to an agent, they sort of feel like, well, I'm talking to this agent. I'm not. And it's a different feeling. But I will say that also, like, a lot of that divides along axes of, number one, is it disclosed? Like, the big axis is like, if you know it's going to be AI going into it, oftentimes people have a very different reaction than if they're surprised to discover they thought they were going to talk to a human and now they are speaking to an AI. Like, that can easily get people to be angry. But then the other one is just like, who's in charge in this call? Like, who has the power? Because a lot the people who are interviewing for the jobs, they wanted the job. So they were kind of like, well, I'm going to treat this like a normal interview. Not all of them. Some of them were like, peace out. Like, I'm done with that. I'm not doing this. There were those, but there were many of them who were just like, seemed like, okay, I'm going to treat this like a normal interview. Now, then when Kyle talks to VCs or even people who make the very technology that he is built on, they're kind of like, I don't have time to be talking to some AI right now. Like, they are the people responsible for AIs being like this technology existing. But they're also like, my time's too valuable to be dealing with someone's AI, which is an interesting dynamic. They don't like it either. So I don't know exactly what that portends for the future, but I did find those relationships and those axes pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's super fascinating, actually. That idea that they facilitated the making of it, and then when they get subject to using it, they're like, oh, that's not for me to use. That's for other people to use.
Yeah. Or almost like, it's not fair for you to use it that way. Like, I didn't know I was going to be talking to an AI. It was like, what do you think was going to happen? Like, you made this technology, released it, and in a general sense, as an industry, are fighting against anyone trying to control it in any way. So like, what do you think is going to happen? People are going to use it all sorts of ways, including this is the mildest way that you could possibly be a victim of an AI. It's like getting out a video call you thought was with a human
CEO. Yeah, where
it's
trying to give you something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Versus take something from you. That's the scary part everybody has. But it's this, I don't want to talk to an AI. Well, okay. Who would you rather, it depends who my alternative is. Do I really just want to talk to another person, or is it a specific other person I have in mind I'd rather talk to? Because there's a lot of people I would prefer to talk to an AI over. If I was given a choice, like, I want to know specifically who it's being replaced for before I make that call.
Yeah, and I mean, it's possible that like a lot of the content in season two is going to seem quaint, right, in just a few short years, because people's reactions, like even VCs, like, I'm not going to take a pitch from an AI agent. You know, in a couple of years, they might be taking the majority of their pitches from people's AI agents who are like fully optimized to give the best possible pitch.
That kind of brings me to something I wanted to bring up, which may bore the crap out of people. I hope not. But game theory. There's like, let's say these conferences people go that are way into game theory and they try out their theories, right? And the one that's most fascinating and tends to be the most successful one is one called Tit for Tat. It's super, super simple. Two parties start in cooperation. So your default is to cooperate in the beginning. And then all you do is mirror exactly the last move the other person made. So if the other person did something cooperative, you do something cooperative. If the other person defected and did something, then you defect. But then if they go back to cooperative, then you go back. So there's total forgiveness, absolutely. But you just mirror and you just go back and forth. And it tends to yield not just a winner, it also is the best for all parties involved. Everyone came with complex game theory algorithms, but this is the one that just wins. And the craziest part is that even after it won and everyone knew what the strategy was, it still won. In fact, it is even more effective when you know that that's the strategy that's being played. Now, the one issue with the strategy is if you misperceive the other side as defecting when they're not, then it gets into this escalation loop. Because I think you're lying, then I lie back, then you lie back. And if we're both playing tit for tat and we're misunderstanding the other person, then it grows into an escalation. And that's how it sort of explains, like, when the system misunderstands, when you misunderstand the system, then it starts to escalate. The interesting thing about these systems that if we understand these things better and we don't anthropomorphize them, they're less likely to escalate because we understand they don't have intention. And so what becomes critical, this is just a long way of saying transparency is probably the absolute future of AI, meaning I won't use an AI that I can't see exactly how every decision was made. I want to see the system prompt. I want to see the data that's fed into it. I want to see all of the symbolic code that it creates. That closed source software, closed source systems, hidden system prompts, no chance those things survive, because that's what will create escalation, is the unknown. So does that just lead to, I'm going to have my own AIs, I'm going to have full transparency on these AIs, and I'm not going to talk to any other AI without my AI present, like my lawyer, you know, that I trust present? And is that it? Online just becomes this layer where I have my AI or multiple AIs, and they'll do all the interaction for me because I'm, as a human, a liability in the system. I'm too susceptible to being manipulated. And so our phones, our systems are going to be these open source, trustworthy beings that we communicate online through, and therefore don't have a lot of one-on-one communication.
Well, I would say, I mean, it sounds like there is a better system to be had in what you're describing, but like, you're the most sophisticated possible user of this technology. And the companies that are making it for the hundreds of millions of people using it are not really catering to you. They're just trying to get as many users as possible. So like, even if it were possible for to surface all that information, let's just say, like, I also find that, like, whenever there's anything, whether it's like, we could talk about Moltbook or any of these things, it's just like, what's the prompt? Like, if you don't know the prompt, you don't know anything. And so, But on the other hand, it seems like a UI challenge, let's say, to surface the prompt for every bit of information you ever provide. And not just the prompt, but like the underlying code and like what is going into the decision.
Yeah.
That just would immediately wreck the like usability of the thing, yeah, certainly for like the average person. So it seems like the history of the tech industry of the last 20 years has been like, pursue growth at all costs. And the type of thing you're talking about that would be beneficial both from a societal perspective and a user perspective eventually is abandoned, if it was an idea even at the beginning, because like, yeah, growth is the most important pursuit.
Yeah, I'm so glad you just said that, because this last Friday I spent 5 hours at a marathon conversation in Santa Barbara with the CTO of Patagonia. And this is the exact conversation we had, because very few companies, Patagonia being the exception, are in a position to be trusted, right? Because of the nature of their business model, right? And I was looking at him saying, look, Google could walk into a room and say, do no harm, and everyone will roll their eyes. But you know, Patagonia walks in a room and says, do no harm. They believe them, right? And it made me wonder, like, is Patagonia the only viable business model in the future for AI? Because to your point, I can't understand it. Even me, like, I'm sophisticated, quote unquote. These things surprise me every day. So what I just need is to trust that whoever is providing and I'm doing business with and interacting with has a has the right incentive structure within their organization, A, and that has a value system that's been tested. And so is Patagonia the business model of the companies? Like, does trust becomes not just a nice to have, but it becomes an imperative, and that the Patagonia business model is the future business model?
It would be nice. I mean,
I know. It's optimistic.
Yeah, I'd like to think
but
so.
But you have to, if you look at, I mean, Anthropic, this is, it's not, that's not that far from what Anthropic, you know, why
except
they
for all the capital
started.
They got to return.
Well, now, but I'm saying they were started by people who left OpenAI because they were frustrated that the values that they believed in were not being carried out at OpenAI. That's part of the stated reason why they left. And part of the stated reason why OpenAI started as a nonprofit was to protect humanity from the dangers of AI. And so what happens is it's all well and good to have those ideas, but as you say, as soon as they get hundreds of millions and billions of dollars of capital that now needs to be returned on, those ideas like slowly or quickly go out the window. And so if Patagonia had the ability to like scale up and make AI, like I would support that. But I feel like in the world of building the thing, so far we don't have an example of a company. I mean, Anthropic's maybe the closest thing. Like they still
I
do
agree.
Have some values.
Anthropic's definitely trying their best, right? I mean, it's as good as it gets, because without the capital, you can't do it. There's nothing to be responsible with. They're probably the only way you can thread the needle right now. But that being said, we're in a state where these models are expensive to train. That capital won't be necessary as it moves forward. And so then the Patagonias of the world, I don't think Patagonia is going to create, I know they're not going to create
an AI,
but as a model to influence systemically, the business structure has to change, not the product, right? Not the technology. Maybe the company, the corporation is the AI.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, unfortunately, we're in a race right now where no one wants to bother with any of that. But I think in the long term, you like thinking about how these models are made, or maybe there'll be a lot of variety of smaller models. Other companies will come in. Maybe some of these big companies will disappear. Who knows we have no idea what's going to happen. And I'm terrible at predicting the future. In fact, I refuse to predict the future in general as a journalist. I feel like it's a very poor thing to be doing. But all I could say is like, right now, no one's paying attention to the values that you're speaking of. Like, it's just not, it's not happening in the moment as far as I could tell. And it's disturbing, I'd say. It's concerning.
Yeah, it feels like with OpenAI in particular, right? It's like the goal is reaching AGI first, but there's no shared definition of what AGI is within OpenAI. Like, you know, to some people, it's Scarlett Johansson and her. To others, it's every job's replaced. Like, there's no real baseline to work from, which is problematic. Like, it is cool to imagine a world where we all have our own personalized AI that exists to kind of protect us from other AI, and that can, you know, if other AIs are offering transparency, we have our AI that can decipher all the prompts and code and everything and let us know that it's trustworthy. But it doesn't seem like there's a lot of money to be made in giving every single person personalized AI to protect them from other AI. That seems almost like something that people are going to have to start building for themselves.
It feels like everything's been thrown up in the air. A lot's been thrown up in the air, and we have no idea how it's going to settle. And so we're all just trying to like mess around with these things, see how they're useful. And then you get these huge predictions, not just industrial strength predictions, but like world changing end of humanity type of predictions. And I feel like it just clouds everything. Like AGI, it's, you know, imagine like if someone was like developing a new flavor of a food, and that company, they were like, also this technology could create a food that you eat once and you never have to eat again. Like, it's just like ridiculous that like, it just infects like all of your thinking about what is being built, as opposed to just like, this thing is being built. It's useful for this now. It might be useful this in the future, but you don't have any reliable narrators among the people who are making it. So it's sort of hard to respond to a company that says like, well, we're making this thing and we're going to sell ads into it, which is like the jankiest kind of like okay, that's just like internet commerce. But also within 2 or 3 years, we think it's going to be a super intelligence. It's like, how are we supposed to deal with that? Like, I don't believe you, but also like, I guess you could be right. I just feel like we're thrown into this sort of like chaotic thinking environment right now, because, which is maybe a long way of just avoiding answering what you said, but like, I have no clue. Like, maybe we all will have our own protective AI, but we have to build it ourselves, or maybe it'll be personalized, or maybe we'll all just be using like the one winner of between the frontier models. Like, who the hell knows? Because like, I don't even trust any of the people who know the most about it to tell me what's going on.
Right. Because they don't know. Because if someone is telling you what's going on, they're pretending. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, they're making up science fiction scenarios. And like, it's impossible to say, you literally cannot say like, well, that can't happen. Like, it can't become AGI. Like, yes, of course, like, it is a theoretically possible thing, but you can't counter it because they're the ones with the technology. So they're always like, well, internally, we might have reached AGI already. It's like, what? Okay, sure.
Yeah. it's such a general thing. And it's this idea that it's probabilism entering our world, you know, when so much of our software is deterministic and we feel this control and we're like, It's not a technology. It's just a different way of thinking and a different way of solving problems. And it, like you said, it affects everything. What if food changed? It changes everything. Vacations,
right?
Daily life, mornings, afternoons, evenings. And to try to imagine what that world that everything changes looks like. Yeah, it's almost silly, right? And so you go like, let's just talk about the boring stuff. Or let's talk about what's not going to change, because that seems probably more productive. So many things will change. Let's talk about what won't change. Mm. In your mind, what won't change?
I mean, I always go to that question in general. I would go to like, AI is not going to pick up my children from school and like walk home with them. You know, like I always go places like that. Like so many things in your life are not going to be touched by lists unless you're like on the very extreme end of the sort of like, I call my AI wife every morning in the car, and then like I talk to my AI children at night. In the context of the experiments that I was running and the stories that I was telling, you know, it's really, I wouldn't say it's like groundbreaking, the conclusion, but it's sort of like there is value in human relationships and in the friction of human relationships that is sort of disappeared when people are talking about AI replacement kind of stuff. And that includes AI employees and job disruption. Now, I'm not saying that it won't happen. Like, I think it'll happen even if it's shitty and bad. But I do think like there is this way in which a lot of the people who are selling AI employees, AI agents in your organization, think of people doing a job as kind of just like a bundle of skills. Here's a skill. AI can do this skill. It can make a spreadsheet. This job includes making spreadsheets. Therefore, this AI agent can replace this person. And I think that's the mentality of a lot of the thinking. But if you've worked for any time in an organization and you really spend time thinking about what people do, then that's just not what a job is. Like a job is not just like doing a small skill. Like my job is writing. Like that's what I do. That's what I've done for my whole professional career. The actual typing of words into a computer is like a small part of what I do, which includes like getting assignments and going out in the world and talking to people and trying to synthesize all that sort of stuff. And I think that's true of like many, many jobs, even so-called bullshit jobs, which like I get into in the show as well. Like,
yeah.
And so that to me, it all just sort of like the optimistic thing is like the more you use AI, I feel like for many people, there is a little bit of a boomerang effect where you're like, actually, I want to spend more time with people. Like that does happen. Actually, I want to think about if it forces to think about the value of people in organizations and like, what is this relationship or what is mentorship or what, why am I interacting with this person this way? Like, I think that could be valuable. That's a little pie in the sky to say that's going to happen at some broad level. But I think that to me is like one of the things that I take away from it.
Yeah. I think two things, like one, you just sort of imagine you're fake employees now add fake customers. How boring does that get? Right? Like
what's the point?
Everyone tunes out. Like, okay, that got boring. It was only fun when you put like humans in there to see how. So they were the only interesting part of the story. Is the, without the humans, it becomes boring and not interesting anymore. Without the phone call to an actual person, it starts to get boring really fast. If it's a robot on both sides, you're like, okay, let's go do something else. What's the else? What's the thing you're gonna go? Let's go find a human. That's the human part that's interesting to us. The idea that we're gonna get consumed in an all robot world and get lost probably doesn't make a lot of sense. It might happen to some, like you said, but maybe only the ones that humans aren't an option.
Joshua Gans talks about, I think it's at the San Francisco airport or something, there's like a machine with a robot in a box making you coffee, and that there's never a line. And I think like what he was describing that could have sort of a slightly optimistic side to it is AI kind of flattening some of the middle layers in companies and really the tools enabling the frontline workers to spend more time having human to human interactions. And then, you know, at the top end of the company, there's way more transparency. There's no longer like a middle layer to kind of cover up for bad decisions that are being made at the top end. So there could be a world where companies are flatter and held more accountable, and, you know, there are lots more opportunities for people to have meaningful interactions with other humans. But again, like getting there requires, it feels like it requires some measure of clarity that's become exceptionally hard to have or to find as we have all these like weird amorphous talking entities floating around in the world.
Yeah. And maybe, I mean, probably it's just some sort of process to get to where it's going to end up. Like, you know, you've seen these cases already of, we're going to lay off X hundreds of people. And then, you know, 6 months later, quietly, like, we hired, you know, 50, 100, 200 people.
Yeah.
Because it looks so promising to someone who's just like counting beans, but actually like you're losing track of what the people in your organization actually do. So I think that could be the case. And like, I mean, this is why I'm never sort of like pro or anti the technology. Like, I love a story of a sort of like worker who's like getting over on the boss because the boss doesn't realize how powerful AI is. Like, I love those stories. They're just like, yeah, I'm working like half as much, and like I go pick up my kids every day because my boss doesn't realize that like a bunch of my work can now be done if I put it through an AI. Like, I don't know. It's like hard not to get behind that to a certain extent from a human perspective. You know, it's going in all directions. But of course, the broad scale sort of like, looks like AI can do their job, so we're restructuring and here goes 1,000 jobs. Like, that is, you know, that's real also. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What Joshua Gans says, there's a lot to dig into and we won't be able to do on this episode, but he just like says, you know, the whole existence of an airport, restaurants, and all of the things that exist in an airport is all on the basis that, you know, humans do a bad job of keeping things going on time. So we like have these whole business structures that are like middleware. They're all about,
he called them cathedrals to hiding uncertainty.
Yeah. and those are businesses, right? And we're like, okay, so those go away because these are really prediction machines at the end of the day. And so now flights, you don't have to get there and sit there and find something to do for 45 minutes. But then time doesn't go away. So what are you going to do? Like, that just, then what are you going to do with that 45 minutes? Something else. Some other business will need to exist to fill those 45 minutes. It's not like it's a zero-sum game when it comes to time, in that sense that we can just cut time away and be asleep all day. So it's just the question of, you said it, like, we can't predict what will replace airports. How could we? It's going to be something ridiculous, though. That's all I know. Something that makes no sense to us now. And airports will make no sense to us then. That's all I know.
But I love that question. I mean, the question that we ask in the show is also, okay, if AI makes you more efficient, what do you do with that time? That's like the final question of episode 8 of season 2. And like, I do think in this environment, that is something we could all focus on, you know? But if you save that time and then you just spend it on something like scrolling AI slop all day, or just doing more of the different kinds of tasks that you've already offloaded to AI, like, what's the point of that? Like, what's gained? Like, to me, that efficiency is completely meaningless. Now, if you spend that time in a meaningful way, then yes, that efficiency is potentially valuable to you. So, like, I feel like that is a question that we should at least be posing.
I know. I had a buddy who said if Elon got the chip going, he would get one definitely. And I said to him, like, I will never talk to you again. And not because I don't like you or I think that's bad, but you may as well just put Siri on your phone, leave it on the table and walk away. Because now that's, I'm just talking to Siri. Who are you? I don't want to talk to your phone. There you go, Siri. Right on cue. I don't want to talk to your phone. That's the end of our conversation. And if I have one, we could just set two phones on this and we could just go somewhere else. And where are we going to go? Like, who wants that? Who wants to be around that person?
I agree. Even as a person who has been that person only for the purposes of producing a podcast.
Well, guys, this was great.
Yeah, thanks, Evan.
Hey, thanks.
We really appreciate you taking the time with us today.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure.
Thanks for hanging out with us today on Invisible Machines. Remember to like, subscribe, and or follow us wherever you get your podcast media. Thank you to OneReach.ai for their support, and much gratitude to the many people working behind the scenes to make this podcast great. Until next time, Owagi.